This is Endocrine Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome back to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our 10th episode. For this episode, we return to the literature on adrenal insufficiency to learn how a new treatment approach compares to our current method. This clinical trial in the JCENM will also help us better understand many of the newest analytic methods in steroid metabolism and how those might relate to clinical outcomes. As usual, we'll take a close look at the methodology to give us insight into these results and conclusions. For today's episode of the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast, as always, two endocrinologists join me to help us walk through this article. As a quick reminder, I work as a general endocrinologist at Vanderbilt University, where I am one of the program directors for the fellowship, and I also host Endocrine Feedback Loop. Our regular contributor comes to us from Columbia University in New York. Salila Kira holds many positions there, including program director for their fellowship and advisory dean and endocrine section director for the medical school. Additionally, she directs the Adrenal Center at Columbia and helps lead educational efforts at the Endocrine Society. Our guest expert today is Andrea Utz, who is the adrenal and pituitary specialist at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville. She directs the pituitary center there and teaches extensively in the medical school and training programs. She's widely recognized for her expertise in these fields, contributing to guidelines from the Endocrine Society. So we've got two great folks today to help us analyze this paper. As usual, everything we discuss are our opinions only and not necessarily those of our respective institutions or of the Endocrine Society. Our article today is Improved Urinary Cortisol Metabolome in Addison Disease, a prospective trial of dual-release hydrocortisone, which is in the March edition of the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. The first author is Stephanie Esbjard from Sahlgrenska University Hospital at the University of Gothenburg in Sweden. Salila, I'll now turn the discussion over to you to walk us through the main points that the authors make in their introduction and to also help us better understand several important issues related to the treatment of adrenal insufficiency. Salila?
Great. Thank you, Chase, for inviting me to be here. So I'm excited to go over this article. And basically, they start by discussing in the introduction the role that synthetic hydrocortisone has in the treatment of adrenal insufficiency, and in particular, primary adrenal insufficiency, and how synthetic hydrocortisone is really integral to the treatment of the primary adrenal insufficiency. They then go on to discuss that because of the short half-life, conventional hydrocortisone therapy requires several doses to achieve sufficient coverage during the day. And it usually involves a higher dose in the morning, as all of us as endocrinologists know, and a lower dose midday. And then there are some patients that require a third dose in the late afternoon. And what this paper looks at is comparing three doses of hydrocortisone to a dual release hydrocortisone therapy.
Yeah, so Andrea, why don't you kind of want to give us your perspective on this? So first of all, kind of give us an overview, because there are a few other options besides just this hydrocortisone. So what are your thoughts on the options that are out there? Give us a quick overview of that and what your preference is when you treat your patients with primary adrenal insufficiency.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me. When I was thinking about how do we think about this paper and what might this provide for us, what I think as endocrinologists, we're always trying to think of is how can we best optimize the regimens of cortisol replacement for our patients? And I think also as endocrinologists, we like to think that we're mimicking normal cortisol production and metabolism, and how can we best replace that? And then what are we going to use to determine whether we're doing that? Are we going to use biochemistry, or are we going to use clinical parameters to determine how to do that? So I think we take all of that in when we're trying to decide our dosing. And we know that cortisol is produced in both a circadian pattern as well as an ultradian pulsatile pattern during the day. So I think we can, in some ways, work to try to improve the circadian pattern. That pulsatile ultradian pattern is a lot harder to reproduce with external dosing. And we know generally how much cortisol a person makes during the day. I think one thing we've learned over the last 15 or so years is that the amount of cortisol we thought people used to make 30 milligrams or so a day was more than what is probably true with better methods to analyze that. And probably 10 to 20 milligrams a day is closer to what an average production rate is. And I think because of that, most of us have moved down on our dosing of hydrocortisone to more closely mimic that lower dose. And that's probably helped to really significantly benefit some of the kind of negative effects we see with higher doses. So how do we do that? What different medications do we have for doing that? I think many of us use hydrocortisone or cortisone to replace cortisol. Certainly hydrocortisone is cortisol. Cortisone requires activation by 11-beta-HSD1 for its activity. I think also some people use prednisone more commonly, or its activated form prednisolone. The dosing of hydrocortisone in the 15 to 25 milligrams a day, I think, is relatively standard. Prednisone, probably a dose in the 3 to 4 milligrams a day. Certainly dexamethasone is a glucocorticoid steroid, but I think should be used in only certain situations, potentially in CAH when trying to suppress adrenal androgens, as a glucocorticoid replacement is likely too potent, too long a half-life, leading to overstimulation of the glucocorticoid receptor. And just like Slea was saying, that we try to mimic the circadian pattern by dosing twice or three times a day with oral hydrocortisone. But unfortunately, cortisol has its earliest peak at 4 or 5 in the morning before most of us are awake. So the ability to be able to get that early morning rise is very challenging with the regimens we have. Because in addition, at nighttime, the levels should be quite low. So we cannot provide a nighttime dose and allow that low level and also allow cortisol in the early mornings. And I think that's why there's been just a lot of interesting work done to try to come up with some novel therapeutics that might be able to recreate this. And just like in this study, this idea of having a dual release hydrocortisone that provides a continuous early peak in cortisol and then a continuous decline over the day with low levels at night is one approach, so that one does not have to continue to dose over the day and doesn't increase those peaks later in the afternoon. But that does not allow for the early morning rise in cortisol before one awakens. And there are some other ways that have been studied. There is a slow a formulation that is a timed release formulation that potentially could be taken at nighttime with that allows the peak earlier in the day, and then another dose in the morning to cover over the daytime. That's not yet available universally, but at some point that may be something we'll have a podcast about in the future. And also some other interesting studies looking at infusion of cortisol with subcutaneous infusions, allowing either continuous infusion of different doses over the day, or also some studies have been done where the cortisol is released in pulses over the day, both in that kind of ultradian fashion as well as the circadian. So I think that these are all interesting topics, ways to think about what we, you know, how we might dose this, but we don't have a lot of data yet to say what might be the best way to do that. And that's what I think our topic today is going to look at.
So that's great. And I think that leads to another point that they bring up in the introduction, which is that with the current like BID and TID dosing that we have, they have noted increased morbidity and mortality really from cardiovascular disease and increases in infection. And there's this possibility that dosing in these different methods, and Andrew, you brought up a lot of different ways that cortisol could be administered that better mimic our own circadian rhythm, some of which are not available for use, but others like this dual release that, you know, that they postulate that maybe this can help with decreasing cardiovascular risk and infection risk and increase or quality of life, although they don't really address that in this study, but it is something that I think comes into all of our minds when we think about giving patients glucocorticoids. And really a lot of us, in terms of how we sort out whether somebody is on enough glucocorticoids or not, there are no real biomarkers available for use. And we really just get an idea of how the patient is feeling. And I think it's an interesting discussion on how really that we can figure out whether a patient is on enough or on too much glucocorticoids based really on a subjective sense of well-being, as opposed to with, you know, the thyroid or other disease states that we treat as endocrinologists, we have biomarkers that really guide our therapy.
Yeah. So Salila and Andrea, how do you guys decide that? Because it really is unusual. There are some other things to where we can't rely heavily on labs, but it's pretty unusual. In endocrine, we almost always have a lab, and that in a lot of ways is where we start, and that helps us figure out where we're at. And there's just not much. I mean, you know, maybe you can do things like check an ACTH just to make sure that you haven't fully normalized it, because then you're overdosing them. But we really don't have a great test that tells us, hey, we're doing really well here. So how do you two figure out when you're dosing if you think it's a good dose or if you need to go up or down on it?
Well, we don't have a lab test, but when I was thinking about this idea that we don't have a biomarker, in a way we have too many biomarkers, and we have too many clinical aspects that we need to think about. That cortisol is so ubiquitous in function and plays so many roles that we have weight, we have blood pressure, heart rate, bone density, edema, skin changes. We have myriad different clinical findings that we can use. And so I think that what I was saying before about how we have these ideas of what correct and average doses are, in clinical reality, we use the patient's report to us about how they feel in many ways to guide timing of dosing and amount of dosing. So I frequently ask people, do you have frequent lightheadedness? Are you fatigued? Do you have headaches? Do you feel like you're able to do your usual activities during the day? Are you able to get to sleep at night? Can you stay asleep at night? Do you find mood changes? Are there things related to that? And I also then quiz them, what time of day are you taking your dose? Are you taking it midday? Are you taking it too late at night? So I try to find, one of the common questions I ask is, when do you feel the worst during the day? And I try to then say, okay, how does that correlate? Is that longer since they took their dose? Is it closer to when they took their dose? So I think it does, for this particular aspect of medicine, it requires a lot of pulling the information out of the patients in terms of how they feel.
Yeah, I think you brought up a great point, Andrea, that there are almost too many biomarkers with this. And there's so many other things that influence these other biomarkers too, in terms of bone density, diabetes, and blood sugar control. And it's hard to sort out what's exactly caused by the hormonal supplementation we're giving them versus just all the other things that can affect metabolism. And I guess my practice is always to try to use as low a dose as the patient can tolerate and still does well on. And also, having said that, I have a fair amount of patients on prednisone because of how difficult it is for them to take hydrocortisone, the second dose in the afternoon. And I have almost no one on a third dose just because of the fact that it's so hard to remember to take three pills every day. But I use many of the same things that you spoke about, which is just how patients are feeling, whether they feel fatigued, what's happening with their blood pressure. And the fludrocortisone dosing is probably a little more straightforward in that there is a bit of a biomarker in that you can look at the renin levels. But when it comes to the glucocorticoids, I think I use many of the same things that you have discussed. So I think that it factoring these other things like the bone density and the A1C is an important thing to think about too. So, you know, moving on to this new formulation, which was, it's a modified release that's designed to, again, obtain this more physiologic circadian rhythm that we talked about. And it's a once a day medication that has an immediate release coating, and then with an extended release core that I'm not sure if it exactly mimics what's happening in your body endogenously, but I think their point is that it's perhaps more closely related to endogenous function than the current methods that we use. And there is a lot of discussion in this paper about the local activation of cortisol from cortisone by the 11-beta-hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase type 1, which is turns cortisone into cortisol in the key glucocorticoid target tissues such as the liver, the adipose tissue, and bone and muscle, and can augment the local effects of glucocorticoids. And because 11 beta hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase 1, it's a mouthful saying this enzyme, is induced by cortisol itself, it's reasonable to postulate that some of the consequences of our current glucocorticoid replacement therapies may be related to altered tissue enzyme activity. And I think that's an important thing to think about and discuss with regards to what effects that these different regimens may have on the different enzymes involved in cortisol metabolism.
I think one of the important things we want to think about too is how we deliver these drugs. So obviously we primarily, how we clinically practice now is to deliver these drugs orally with a high first pass metabolism potentially to the liver, and how that might affect 11-beta-HSD1 activity as opposed to what would be endogenous when released from the adrenal. And I think that that's part of one thing we cannot control with our current medication regimens.
And one of the things that they use in this study is urinary steroid profiling, and there are many different assays in this study. And Andrea, I'm curious to hear your overview about the different assays that they've used and, you know, how we should be evaluating this data based on that.
Sure. So I think we have history using immunoassays in many cases for our steroid levels more recently, but I think as mass spec has become more commonly used, a little more readily accessible, not as expensive as it used to be, now we use liquid chromatography mass spec for analyzing the major cortisol and its precursors. But in this particular study, what they used was gas chromatography and mass spec. And that's been long used for several decades, used to look at steroid metabolites, because it's a way of providing a integrated look at all the different metabolites that are produced of cortisol and the androgens and the mineralocorticoids at one time, because that the gas chromatography provides the ability to distinguish between molecules that are very similar in their structure that prior liquid chromatography wasn't able to do as well, although that is improving. So the good thing about the gas chromatography kind of steroidalome is that it gives us a full insight of what might be modified by the various interventions that we do. So it gives us an idea of how these drugs that we provide are metabolized relative to what would be normal. And for anyone interested, I want to highlight there are some excellent reviews of these various gas chromatography and liquid chromatography by Rich Aukus, and he has excellent reviews. There was an excellent one in Hormones and Cancer in 2011 that I think that we as endocrinologists need to become more and more able to understand these assay techniques to figure out how they're going to fit in. And I think, just as one aside, I think that where this is used more commonly now is being able to phenotype the steroid metabolites that are involved in adrenal nodules. So this is something that I think is moving into a more commonly used aspect of endocrinology. So it's not so outside the norm to think about this in terms of using it to decide if we're dosing people correctly.
Great, thank you. That was really helpful. And I think you bring up a salient point that it's important for us as endocrinologists to understand these assays and when and how to use them. And so, you know, the study aim here is to define alterations in cortisol metabolism with immediate and dual release hydrocortisone in patients with primary adrenal insufficiency compared to healthy controls, and in addition to assessing a possible impact on metabolic outcomes.
Good. Thank you, Salila. So I think that really sets us up nicely there to understand what we know, how we do things now, but also this big area of unknowns and why we need to think about approaching treatment other ways and why this sort of study is needed. So what we're going to do, like we normally do, is take a look at the methodology here. And as usual, we're going to take a close look at the study design and how that works. And as has been mentioned already, this is a clinical trial, and specifically, it's a crossover RCT. So we're going to talk a little bit about clinical trials. And I think very often we just get used to mentioning that they are the gold standard, they're the best, and we don't always think about why they're so good. And I think that's helpful here as we look at this, about what's particularly strong and maybe some weaknesses that go along with the study design that's used here. So specifically, when we think about observational studies, and we look at a lot of those on this podcast that are published in the society's clinical journals, there are several issues that you have to think about that are intrinsic to observational studies, weaknesses that can be there. And a couple of categories that we always think about, confounding is one of them, and bias is another one. And RCTs do a particularly good job at addressing both of those. But I think it's important to understand why that's the case. So confounding, as a reminder of what that is, so whenever you have a study, you are essentially always looking at what you have labeled as an exposure and then trying to see how that relates to an outcome of interest, if that's causing an outcome. And what confounding is when you were looking at something, when you've labeled something as your exposure, but really what it is there's something else that you're maybe not aware of that is related to your labeled exposure, but it's this related thing that's driving the outcome, not what you have actually said is your exposure of interest. And that's what confounding is. That's what a confounder is. And then the other issue is bias. And we use this term a lot in many different situations outside of research. And it means a similar idea in all those settings. A bias is treating one group of people differently than another group. And it's the same in biomedical research. And what happens in that situation is it's particularly an issue in observational studies, is because you are treating somebody differently, whether they are in an exposed group or an unexposed group. Often this is unintentional. You don't know that you're doing it, but as investigators, you can be prone to doing that. Also subjects, those who are participating in the study can be prone to doing that as well. They may behave differently because they know that they're in an exposed group or an unexposed group. And the reason that RCTs are so good at dealing with this is a couple of different issues. So the first ones are going back to confounding. How do RCTs deal with that? And it's the randomized aspect that deals with that. So instead of risking that one group versus another have more of these confounders, what RCTs do is they randomize people. That's how you get into one group or another. Nobody's putting there. You're not putting yourself there on purpose. And so what happens is if you've done your randomization correctly, you perfectly balance those confounders out. You don't get rid of them. They're still there, but they largely are going to cancel each other out. So that's how that works. And then the other issue with having a bias, that's where blinding comes in. So if you as an investigator don't know whether a subject is taking your medication or not, and then also if you as a subject in a research study don't know if you're on a medicine or a placebo, then you can't really be treated differently. So that's why RCTs are so good, because they can deal with those issues so effectively. So now what we're going to do is look at this study and see how that works. And a particular note is this is a crossover RCT. So that's even yet another more specific type of randomized controlled trial. And what happens in a crossover RCT is that all of the subjects participate in all of the groups. So if you have, say, two groups, you've got an exposed and an unexposed group, you sequentially go through those groups. And so what makes that such a strong study design is that the confounders are essentially perfectly balanced, because they are the same people. The subjects in the exposed group are the same subjects that are in the control group, just at different points in time. And so really effectively deals with confounding there. So now let's actually take a look at this study. We'll go through, I'm going to describe what this is. There's a lot of words, but we will unpack it. So this is an open, randomized, two-arm, two-period, 12-week crossover multi-center trial. It's like, okay, a little overwhelming there with all those words. So what does that mean? So first of all, this is an open study. So that's an important thing to know. And that is the opposite, essentially, of a placebo control. So when it's open, the subjects and the investigators know whether you are being treated or not. And we get particularly concerned about that if you are studying outcomes that are easily influenced by knowing whether or not somebody's being treated. So if you were looking at symptom report, if a subject is telling you how they feel, that is highly subject to knowing whether you are on a medication or not. So you get concerned about that. If there is something, say, a radiology component, and a radiologist might know whether a subject is taking a medication or not, and that could influence how a report is read. those areas you'd be particularly concerned about. If it's, as we'll look in here, primarily more objective data, it doesn't get rid of that as an issue, but it's a little bit less concerning. Okay, so that's, so it's an open study. So randomized, we may say, well, how on earth does that work if everybody's in both groups? How does randomization work there? What's randomized about a crossover RCT is which order you do it in. And so half of the group roughly will be in the control group first, and then the other half is going to be in the experimental group first. And that's a randomization of what order that goes into. So it's two arms. So here, there's just two treatments that are being compared to each other. It's two periods, so you only spend one period of time in each of these groups. Each of these is 12 weeks, and then again, as we talked about, you cross over, you switch from one to the other, and it's multi-center, so it's carried out at multiple locations. So what these are these two groups, these two arms that we're looking at. So one, it's been mentioned, this newer hydrocortisone that is under investigation, this dual release that has the immediate release coating, and then inside of that, it has an extended release course. So that's the newer treatment regimen that's out there. And then what that is being compared to is a conventional 3 times a day hydrocortisone. So it's the same dose. So they were really careful here to make sure that a total daily dose of hydrocortisone is the same. It's just this regimen is different. And it's particularly in patients with primary adrenal insufficiency caused by Addison's disease. So a few of the inclusion and exclusion criteria here is you had to have adrenal insufficiency for at least 6 months. You had to have been on a stable hydrocortisone dose for at least 3 months going into this trial. And as I mentioned before, that dose was kept constant throughout the study. So they did not adjust that regimen at all. They have a host of medicines that could be potentially interfering with steroid metabolism. So they specified you had to be off of any of those for at least 2 weeks before. And then Salila mentioned a lot of these folks, most of these folks are going to be on a mineralocorticoid. And because of its nature of being autoimmune condition, obviously a lot of these people will have hypothyroidism as well. And the investigator specified that if you are on those two agents, that both of them, the dose had to have been stable for at least 3 months. So they're not be concerned about adjustments in those affecting the outcomes. And as we'll look at, there was frequent blood sampling to allow calculations, primarily the area under the curve calculations. And we'll talk about those a little bit in the results, but frequent blood sampling was done for these subjects. As a separate part of this study, they recruited several healthy volunteers for a comparison's sake. So the main part of the study, I think it's important to keep in mind, the main part of the study is comparing, it's only people with adrenal insufficiency, comparing two different treatment regimens. But there is a third group, and that's healthy volunteers, to where they wanted to look at what a normal steroid profile looks like in those individuals. Because as we'll see in the results, they're going to do comparisons, and yes, they're going to compare these two groups of treated individuals, but they're also going to try to make comparisons and say, of these different profiles that are out there with these two groups, which of them are closer to normal? So to be able to say that, then you actually need a third group that is normal in the sense that they don't have an adrenal problem, and say, okay, with normal steroid metabolism, what does that look like? And are we moving closer to that profile or further away from that profile? And then finally, last thing to think about here is some of the urine studies that were done. This was mentioned a little bit already by Salila and Andrea, but it was extensive testing. So as a part of this, there were 32 different steroids that were assessed. And just like Andrea mentioned, it was via gas chromatography and mass spectrometry is how this was done. And there were two main types of analysis that they were attempting to do. And the main one to look at the actual steroid itself was to calculate out a 24-hour excretion rate. But then the other one is trying to understand enzyme activity. And so the way that looked at was taking products and substrates of these different enzymes of interest and looking at those ratios, again, in the urine study, and then inferring from that ratio of product and substrate, what the enzyme activity is. And we'll come back to that a little bit and talk about some of the impact that there may be there. And the authors have several good points on that. But before we wrap up the methodology here. Andrea, can you just give us a bit more of an overview? And we've talked about this a little bit already, but for somebody like you or Salila who thinks about this a lot, you're maybe used to this. For somebody like me as a general endocrinologist, I see a list of 32 steroids. I pretty quickly get overwhelmed. I know what some of them are. I don't know what all of them are. And so it can be kind of intimidating looking at a list that like that and trying to think that I really have a good grasp on why you have to check so many of these, what it tells you. So any other thoughts on kind of how this methodology works and why you need so many of these metabolites to understand steroid metabolism?
Well, I think that the good news is that the gas chromatography mass spec gives us this data. We have it to work with, and we can use it by creating profiles to look at how these drugs are metabolized. But it does, in some ways, I think, become overwhelming to say, what does this mean to us? What are the things we can tease out from this that might be useful? So the first step in this study to try to tease that was to really just look at the metabolites of cortisol. So that got rid of the mineralocorticoid and the androgen metabolites. We're really focusing on about a third of that to look at how this drug gets metabolized. And I think a really important take-home point of why we do these metabolites is we're looking primarily at ratios, and those ratios and what that provides us is a way to normalize against the total amount of drug that is delivered to the person. So I think one of the really important points that we're going to get at in this paper is this idea of how to deliver similar amounts of drug and how to then say, okay, what if we don't have similar amounts of drug being delivered? What can we tell about how these metabolic pathways are working? So we can do ratios of the metabolites before and after a particular enzyme we're interested in and say, is there more activity of this enzyme versus another enzyme with a particular drug? And that's what is utilized a lot in this paper is I think the enzymes that are most important that we're looking at are the 11-beta-HSD1, the 11-beta-HSD2, and then the 5-alpha and beta reductase activities. And I think those are the ones that we're going to think about the most when we're thinking about this paper and using these metabolites and their ratios to determine the activities of those enzymes.
Good. That's it. That's helpful. Thank you for that overview. All right. So Leela, I'm going to turn it back over to you to walk us through the myriad of results that we have here to try to help us make sense of the findings that they had here. So why don't you kind of walk us through the results and help us understand that?
Sure. Thank you. So yeah, moving on to the discussion. So there were 50 patients and 22 of whom were women and 28 were men with primary adrenal insufficiency, and they were included in this analysis with a mean age of 47. And the average hydrocortisone dose per day was 30 milligrams. I did want to pause there and just discuss, Andrea, you had brought up that initially we used to think that 30 milligrams was the amount that the average person made, but with the time we realized that people actually probably make less and require less. So I'm curious to see both your impressions of this, what I would call a relatively high dose of replacement therapy.
I suspect they might have chosen a higher dose to try to eliminate symptomatology of low dosing. So choosing a relatively higher dose would allow you not to have to increase the dose, feel like you have to increase the dose in the patient, pushing it up to the higher end so that they're not, so you are worried less about lower blood pressure and symptoms. So I think that when you're doing a study that's only going to last 12 to 24 weeks, you might be able to get by with having a relatively higher dose.
Yeah, I do think it potentially does call into question if you're thinking about, well, is this going to be automatically applicable if I'm thinking about switching somebody who's maybe a total daily dose of half of that? I think it is a good point. And Salil, I think you had identified that as we were initially analyzing this article. So I do think it is a good point to say that this isn't really what we have probably most of our patients. And it may not make a difference, but we don't know that for sure. The other thing that came to mind for me is we don't know for sure. So Andrew's saying, well, maybe this was a ramp up going into this. I think it's also possible that these were folks who, for whatever reason, were on a higher dose here. So it does make you wonder if this is potentially a specific subset of patients with adrenal insufficiency, maybe ones who aren't feeling well on a regimen like this. And you'll always wonder about the possibility of folks who volunteer for these studies are not always representative of the general population of a condition. And so you would wonder, well, maybe that is supportive of this. And it's always a possibility in these sort of trials. I think we don't know for sure, but it is a potential limitation that they are on that high of a total daily dose.
Yeah, those are great points and interesting things to think about. And moving on to the control group, they had 124 healthy controls, 73 of whom were women and 51 men, again, with a mean age of 48, so very similar in age and other characteristics. And after 12 weeks of treatment, body weight and systolic blood pressure decreased with the dual-release hydrocortisone as compared with the TID hydrocortisone, but they did not note a difference in diastolic blood pressure. So, you know, I think this would be a good time to discuss the changes that they did see, which was about a 0.6 kilogram change in weight and a 4 milligram per mercury change in blood pressure. So, you know, is that clinically meaningful? And what do we think about these changes that were seen between the dual release and the TID groups?
Well, I think that we certainly always want to see them moving in that direction, of course. So any decline in weight is going to likely be appreciated, as well as blood pressure. I think that one of the really important pieces of data we want to bring out is, how do we compare, what was the true exposure that these patients had to hydrocortisone? And what we learned in table one with the area under the curve is that those that were, even though the dose was the same on average, the actual area under the curve was different for these patients. So that the area under the curve for the dual release was actually lower. So that probably has to do with decreased bioavailability of this particular formulation of drug. And so we think that we're giving them the same drug, but they're actually not absorbing as much. And so studies that have looked at trying to say, what effect does it have when we lower hydrocortisone dosing? Some of those studies have suggested that there is a weight improvement, possibly some blood pressure improvement, maybe bone density improvement. But what we haven't necessarily seen is a significant improvement in quality of life with lower doses. So I think that for this particular drug in this study, we're probably seeing a relatively lower amount of delivered hydrocortisone to these study patients when they take dual release. And potentially that has a beneficial effect on the metabolic parameters.
Yeah, and I agree with Andrea on that. Always good to see it moving in the right direction. Not a huge difference. You wonder how much of it is because it's a relatively brief study, only 12 weeks. So it's hard to know if you would see more of an impact if this regimen were continued for longer. So that's speculation. It's possible that it could be more if you just gave it more time. But yeah, hard to know. And I agree with Andrea on that. I think really what we're going to be interested in seeing is that when they do this different analysis, so area under the curve being one, but then all these other studies, particularly looking at the urine, is how well that correlates to these clinical parameters, even if that's not the main outcome that was being looked at here.
Yeah, I had the same impression as well, that it was a 12-week study, but things went in the right direction. So, you know, a little bit of weight loss in 12 weeks is good. And to your point, Chase, we don't know whether it would be more if the study were longer, but it's an important thing to think about. And then to compare the regimens in a little bit more detail, the dual release versus the TID dosing, the dual release had lower urinary cortisol, cortisone, and metabolites. The 11-beta-HSD1 appears decreased and the 11-beta-HSD2 appears increased. When you look at the TID versus the controls, the TID urinary cortisol and cortisone were 3 times higher, and this was significant even after adjusting for sex, age, and weight, and with similar metabolites. When you look at the dual release versus the control, the dual release urinary cortisol and cortisone were higher, but the metabolites were lower. So the daily cortisol exposure was associated with the 11-beta-HSD2 activity, but there was no correlation with the 11-beta-HSD1 activity. And the weight and blood pressure changes were not correlated with the cortisol metabolites.
Good. So thank you, Salila, for giving us a good, intentionally kind of a high-level overview. In this paper, there are, as you would expect, if you're looking at just from the urine studies alone, 32 different metabolites. There's a lot of data and a lot of information here. So I think that that's helpful, giving us that very high-level summary overview. So we're going to, as we move into the discussion, I'm going to hit that again. So the authors do a nice job of summarizing some of these key findings. So we're going to come back to that and really think about that. And in particular, that last thing that Salila said, that some of the clinical parameters that were looked at there don't really seem to correlate very well with those urine studies. So, okay, so let's start with the points that the authors make, and then we'll give you some of our own thoughts on top of that. So as far as the authors' conclusions, they have two really big conclusions that they want to make here. So the first one is that thinking about that traditional three times a day regimen. So that results in a much higher cortisol exposure compared to the healthy controls. And there's also an increase there in that 11-beta-HSD1 activity. So two things that are going on there. But then instead, when you look at the dual release or that new formulation that they're investigating, so that has less of a cortisol exposure compared to the TID, still high, but it's less. And then also the urinary profile is much closer to a normal urinary profile. So again, comparing that to those healthy controls, people without any adrenal disease. So those are the two big things that they're making. So this new medication, this new formulation of hydrocortisone, you're getting less cortisol exposure and your urine metabolites look more normal. So I think that what you're drawing from that is like, okay, this is a good thing. These are the sort of things that we want to see. A couple of other things, the authors do a nice job of reviewing other studies that are out there in the literature, and a couple of points that they make from that. So one is that there is throughout the literature this idea is that increasing the 11-beta-HSD1 may contribute to some of the adverse metabolic effects that are out there. That's not always totally clear, but there is some worry. So that reflects back on their finding that the TID regimen has the higher 11-beta-HSD1. So maybe from the other literature, we can conclude that that would be a worrisome finding that would see there given that association in other studies. And then the second point that they make, and they say there's actually a lot less clear on this point, but what we don't know about is really what is driving a lot of the impact of steroid administration here. Because you can think of different things. This study is primarily looking at total cortisol exposure and this circadian profile. So there's a couple of things there. Andrea walked us through some of that, but thinking about total daily dose, so that's one thing. And not just how much is administered, but how much is actually absorbed. So that area under the curve, thinking about cortisol exposure. But then the circadian rhythm. So we don't really understand necessarily how much of an impact that has. Is it a big deal in actually driving outcomes? And then a third thing that this study didn't really look at all, wasn't designed to look at this, but Andrea alluded to it already, may have a really big impact is the route of administration. So this is only looking at oral administration. There have been studies, though, as Salila pointed out, things that are not currently available, but thinking about subcutaneous administration. So does that have a total impact? Andrea walked us through the impact on the liver, how that's metabolized. So it's easy to understand how that could have an effect. There's other regimens, obviously, in the hospital will frequently use IV. So thinking about that, we don't really understand the relative impact of those three different things. And it can be hard to study one of those in isolation. Often we're looking at the impact of multiple of those together. So still a lot of unknowns there. And with that in mind, the authors then describe several different key limitations. And I do think they do a really nice job of pointing out some of the potential limitations of their study. And I think that the first one is a really important one that we have to spend some time on. And that is that they did not find a correlation between any of these clinical parameters and the steroid profile. So yes, the clinical parameters were different for a couple of these key aspects between the group. And we talked about it as moving in the right direction for this new dual release regimen. Blood pressure was a little bit lower and weight came down a little bit. So both good things there, but that didn't correlate at all with the steroid profile. And I think that we've really got to spend some time thinking about that, because one of the big points, and we'll actually look at this here in a second, is the conclusion that the authors make here ultimately is that this idea of a metabolism is really helpful. So Andrea talked about these ratios and how many we can measure all these ratios and this idea that it's really important. I think what we've got to think about is how important is it if it doesn't seem to be tied to these clinical parameters. So I want to get Andrea's thoughts on that. Salila's thought. There are other caveats. That wasn't the primary design of this to do that. That was kind of a secondary purpose, is to look at clinical parameters. It is a relatively small study. But what are you all's thoughts on that? That lack of correlation.
Well, I think that one of the important things, I'm coming back to the point I made earlier, when I analyzed this data, kind of the difference between the exposed dose between these two patients, I think makes it very hard to compare between the two groups in terms of the metabolites that we're looking at. So when we're looking at what the total urine cortisol or the urine cortisone, those levels are lower in the dual release, but they're probably lower because their exposed dose was lower. And so I think the really two important take-home things from the steroid metabolome is these ratios of the tetrahydrocortisol to the tetrahydrocortisone, giving us an estimate of the 11-beta-HSD1 activity. It was very similar, a little bit statistically closer to control, but still quite similar to the TID dosing. So to me, that the take-home point of that is this alternative formulation had a pretty subtle impact on 11-beta-HSD1 activity. I was actually a little more intrigued by the activity that it had on the 11-beta-HSD2, that potentially that was a somewhat of a bigger impact, that kind of the inactivation of cortisol to cortisone by 11-beta-HSD2 may have been a little bit more significant. So I'm not sure if that's a true signal or not, but that's kind of an interesting idea to me of could that be why there's an improvement in blood pressure, because there's some inactivation of the cortisol. So I think the effect here is subtle, and what we know about even changing from cortisol doses of 30 down to 15, the clinical effect of that we know is pretty subtle. It may, over the length of a person's lifetime, lead to improved cardiovascular benefit over time, but the actual individual effects on blood pressure and weight have been relatively subtle. So it's not really surprising to me that we're not seeing a whole lot of clinical effect in the parameters that they're testing in this study. But like we do in a lot of endocrinology, we're looking for subtle changes that add up over the lifetime of a person to improve their usually long-term cardiovascular risk.
Yeah, I had a similar impression as well, that the findings were more subtle than I would have anticipated, looking at the differences in the area under the curves in terms of how much cortisol the patients were exposed to on the different regimens. And I also, made me wonder that if they were on 15, which is probably a little bit more real world in terms of the dosing, would these changes be even more subtle? And, how generalizable is this to the population of patients that we all see in our practices? So I had similar thoughts to what Andrea already articulated, but I think that for me, I was a little bit surprised by how subtle the findings were.
And so going back, I think the authors make a really good point, as we already talked about, is that really it's unclear what are the big drivers here. If this is cortisol exposure total, if this is the route of administration, is it the circadian exposure profile? And with this study here, with these different regimens, a couple different things are changing. So it is a difference probably in that total cortisol exposure, just like Andrea mentioned, because the area under the curve is different. But then also the exposure profile is a little bit different, as opposed to a 3 times a day regimen where you're getting relatively large, quick spikes of levels, as opposed to that extended release. And maybe that's having a big impact there. So we don't really know what that difference is. And I think we've got to keep that in mind, is that uncertainty is what's driving the differences here. And another limitation that the authors point out that I think is a good one and one that we need to keep in mind with these sort of studies is that the enzymatic activity is, the assessment of that is really limited to the urine studies. And they make a good point that that may not adequately reflect tissue activity. This comes up in a host of things that we think about is that when we are measuring circulating, whether it's from blood test or urine test, we're not necessarily seeing what's happening at the tissue level. And so we may not have a good understanding of that. But I do think that is a good point. There is a big impact on that. It's the idea of we look there because it's relatively easy for us to study that. We can get an answer, even if it's not exactly the question that we're asking. It's an easier one to get an answer to. And so we answer that question and then hope that the answer is similar to the one to the question that we're actually asking. So I wanted to wrap up here with what I alluded to before is this conclusion that the authors leave us with, and I'll give you the quote here, is that they say, our results suggest the urinary cortisol metabolome may serve as a tool to assess optimal cortisol replacement therapy. And so I just wanted us to discuss that as a group. So particularly going back to the idea of, at least in this study, that urinary cortisol metabolome didn't correlate with any of the clinical outcomes. So is that a helpful addition, or do we really need to see that it actually clearly connects with some sort of clinical outcome? It's more objective here. You also have the realm of quality of life, more subjective type things, and it's possible that it'll correlate with that when that's looked at. But do we really feel comfortable making that conclusion yet? So Leela and Andrea, what are your thoughts on that particular conclusion that the authors make?
You know, I'm not sure I would change my clinical practice based on the urinary cortisol metabolome and what, and it's an extra test for our patients to do. And maybe the lack of correlation would make me a little bit reluctant to use that over the more subjective findings that we currently use. You know, I think one thing we always, discuss with our fellows is you should only order a test if you're going to then change your clinical management based on those results. And I'm not sure these tests would make me change my clinical management, especially given that I think that there isn't the correlation that would be required to actually change dosing based on the results.
I would agree. I think that at present, this probably wouldn't change how I think about dosing for the average person with adrenal insufficiency. What I think might be interesting over time will be if this becomes more clinically available and accessible from a cost perspective, what we might learn over time is how there are people who vary in terms of their metabolism of cortisol. And we may see certain profiles that make us say, this is a person who needs more or less cortisol based on their metabolites. And I think that we don't tease that out very well in this study where things are combined, but on an individual patient basis, that might be one way that we do more personalized care in the future if they have potentially a 5-alpha reductase that's a variant that makes them metabolize in a different way that might be useful. So hopefully down the line, we'll be able to use these things, but I'm not sure based on this that we're ready for that right now.
Yeah, so I think we've kind of covered that. We always like to end these discussions thinking about our clinical practice. That's ultimately why these studies are done, is to try to understand if we need to change our clinical practice. So that's one thing that we've talked about already is, well, what about using this? So these things are used in research studies, but they're not widely available. So it sounds like probably nothing that we would be really excited yet unless we were able to clearly see that would help us change clinical outcomes. So I think the last thing that we would want to think about then is this new medication that's under investigation, this dual release hydrocortisone. So that may be available in the future at some point. And so I think that's the other thing is if and when that's available, is that something that we would be excited about based on this data? Particularly thinking, as usually the case, at least in the United States, when new medications come out, that they are usually much more expensive than the older medications. So do we have enough data now to actually recommend to our patients and say, I think it's worth this extra cost because it's a better medication for whatever reason? Or do we feel like we would still need more data before we would actually encourage a patient to make a switch? So Leela, we'll start with you and then Andrea as well. So what are your thoughts about that particular aspect of what other data might we need, or do you feel like we have enough already to answer that question?
Well, I think it's an exciting thing to have a once a day hydrocortisone medication. So I think dual release would be something that I really would look forward to using in the future. Having said that, I'm not sure if I'm convinced enough by the data that are available to suggest changing to it now, especially with what you bring up, which is a very salient point about the costs of new medications and whether or not this would really lead to a significant change in the clinical parameters, such as quality of life and other things that are important to our patients. So I guess I'm not sure if I 100% answered that question, so I don't think I would do it today, but I would look forward to using a once-a-day medication in the future because, as we all know, once-a-day medications really do help with adherence, even with a disease such as Addison's, where people don't feel well when they are off their steroids for too long, but still I think it's hard to take medications two or three times a day. So that aspect of it, I think, is an exciting one that we can have a once-a-day hydrocortisone.
I would absolutely agree. As we all know, we have patients who do better with once a day and others that want to take these medications multiple times during the day, hoping that it will improve quality of life. I look forward to seeing the trial that compares a medication like prednisone to this dual release hydrocortisone, where the kinetic profile of prednisone is quite similar probably to this, with a relatively, I think, a little bit slower initial peak, but a sustained activity for longer during the day. So I think that probably would give a more similar kinetic. So with prednisone, I think there's some increased potency at the glucocorticoid receptor, maybe a little bit more activities. But it would be an interesting head-to-head trial to have those two drugs, one of which is significantly more expensive than the other. And so deciding which one is the right choice based on cost if the data is relatively similar in terms of the clinical outcomes.
Yeah, I think the other helpful thing, and Salila mentioned this, is really thinking about quality of life. And so could there be an impact here? This study wasn't designed. They didn't intend to look at that. And if you're going to look at that, that's the situation to where you really have to have a placebo-controlled trial. So it would need a different study design to be able to answer that question, is do people feel better overall? So even if there are not objectives, not a blood pressure difference, not a weight difference, but does it help with that sense of well-being and what other subjective outcome you want to look at? I think that's another potential thing to where knowing that information in a placebo-controlled trial would be really helpful information to trying to make that decision of would we want to take advantage of this medication for our patients when that's available. And with that, I would like to thank Salila Kira and Andrea Utz for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope you all learned as much as I did and will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.